This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. Welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about the Iraq War and what it's doing to our soldiers and Marines, not only while they're over there, but also when they return. And with me to talk about this is Abby Pickett, who served with the Army National Guard in Iraq. Abby Pickett, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me why you enlisted in the first place.
Well, I guess a lot of it was just childhood naivety and, you know, wanting to do something and give something back to my country. I grew up in a very small town in rural Wisconsin, and my dad was county clerk, which is an elected position, pretty much all my life at that point. And I just kind of, I think at some point, too, it was almost a little bit of rebelling because I grew up in a very democratic household, and, you know, this is a way of kind of looking at things from a different angle.
What did they say when you told them you wanted to enlist?
Well, they had to sign off because I was only 17. And my mom refused to do it. And so I looked at them and I said, what did you always say? That you would support whatever made us happy in life. And this is the one thing I want. And this is what's going to make me happy. So either sign off and support me and do this with me, or I'll join when I'm 18 and by myself and without your blessing. And so you can either be on board and go with me 110% or not at all, and then I'm going to have to, you know, go and do it alone. So I kind of put them up against the wall, probably pretty unfairly, but when you're 17, you know.
and then you, what was boot camp like?
Oh, well, I was supposed to go in the summer of 2000. Things got pushed back until late August of 2001. And we hit a surge because all the people that were like National Guard and were doing split op, which means that they go in the summer, were returning back home. And so all the active duty people who I got lumped with were starting up at that point. And there were so many people coming that we had to wait in what they call like an entrance phase or reception area for an extra couple weeks. And so we didn't start our zero day, which is the day you meet your drill sergeants, was 9/11.
Oh, my.
And I was what they call PG, which stands for platoon guide, which means at the moment I was like standing out in formation of 40 individuals. And we came back from taking our soldier's creed and swearing in and all that kind of fun stuff. And the drill sergeants had us out in this hallway, and I couldn't hear anything because I was standing in front of the formation, and then I heard something about a plane ride and, you know, waiting for further information. Everybody, like, hopped up and went to the barracks, and people were, you know, all upset, and we're going to war, and on and on and on. And I was like, oh, no, they tell you that every time you start basic training. We're fine, you know. If it's the real deal, we'll find out what time. And unfortunately, we did find out what time that it was the real deal. So I think for me, it was the first time I was ever really away from home. So it was a little bit of homesickness, but a lot of it was, you know, I was a very athletic person in high school, and I was excelling. For the first time in my life, I was really excelling. And, you know, I could go out there and I could do 100 sit-ups or whatever they told me to do, and it made me a better individual in the eyes of my drill sergeants. And so I really accepted that challenge, and I liked it. Same time, you know, I also saw how 9/11 directly impacted people. There were people's bags I had to pack up. One girl's father was on the military side of the Pentagon when I got hit in the Army. And another girl that I sat with in line waiting to meet our drill instructors, her father worked in the bottom of the trade towers. They were both yanked from our lines and sent packing. I never heard from them again whether or not their families were affected.
That's intense. So when you joined, it was peacetime. Mm-hmm. And did you join with the expectation that you may face actual battle? Or were you going for different reasons?
Well, no, I think that was my mother's selling point for me not to join was, you know, well, you could go to war. And I was like, well, Mom, if I go to war, it's because my country needs me. And, you know, just this very idealistic sense that if, you know, my country asked me to go to war, I would do it. And there was a point, and, you know, my grandfather had served, and my uncle had been in the Navy, and though he didn't serve in a war, you know, he still gave back service.
And that idealistic sense, did that gradually wear off?
Yeah, definitely. And it was a hard process. It wasn't something that happened overnight. You know, it was something where you're still waking up each morning, you know, 3 months into a deployment that isn't what you expected, and still trying to find some good out of it and still trying to bring good, and sometimes getting shut down for how optimistic or, you know, I was just got together with a friend that I hadn't seen 5 years last night since high school. And we were joking about the fact that we were just these eternal optimists and how life outside of our small, you know, Darlington community has been so hard in the big world. You know, we both moved out to New York for a little bit and we're just like, oh my gosh, you know, this is what the real world was and is. I remember calling home in Iraq and just crying, breaking down for the first time in a long time because I hadn't called home in like 3 or 4 months at that point. And I just, not about the insurgencies, not about, you know, the IEDs or the mortar attacks or stuff like that that were a threat, but more about the people that I served with and how hard it was and how I didn't know that people were actually that cruel.
Well, talk a little bit about that. What was the kind of cruelty that you saw?
I would say that the lessening of, you know, humankind is, you know, people, and it's all the mentality of war, and we've seen it in every war that's ever come and gone, is that you try to dehumanize the other side. And, you know, I was a preschool teacher before I started college, and so I was really used to working with 3-year-old children, and it was really hard for me to, like, hear everyday terms like Haji, which has been controversial on whether or not I can tell you that a lot of times was used in a very derogatory way.
It's like the N-word.
Right, exactly. You know, for me, it was just hard to say. It was hard to hear every day in your briefings. It was hard to think of someone less than a human being.
And in the briefings, just so it's coming from the commanding officers as well?
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of it wasn't, I wouldn't say that they were actually thinking that they were dehumanizing or anything like that. It was just more, it almost became an everyday word. You know, I'm going to go down and I'm going to, if you were going to buy something off the local economy, they would use the H word. Like, you know, I'm going to go and buy a Haji copy of whatever Kill Bill or, you know, the latest movie or DVD was. And so that was just one small way. And I also think that just mentality-wise, things were a lot different. You know, people, you couldn't trust people like you could in Darlington. I mean, I could leave my car unlocked while I ran into the grocery store, and all of a sudden you have to worry about people stealing your own stuff. I mean, from your own squad, from your own team. Mm. You know, the people I served with from Wisconsin, overall, you know, especially the under-enlisted, you know, there's a couple officers that were really great and were really true to the Army Corps values, which idealistically, you know, I believed in. I believed in selfless service and, you know, leadership and courage and all the stuff that goes into being a good soldier. And I think some people just forgot those things as their military career went on.
Hmm. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. My guest this week is Abby Pickett, who served with the Army National Guard in Iraq. Abby, when were you there from?
Well, we were called up, and we were the only unit in the state of Wisconsin to be activated with 48 hours notice. So to give you some kind of sense of that, on February 7th, I just had paid my check for my college tuition. And I went and I checked my email, and it said, to whom it may concern, the 229th has been called to duty. Call your designated armory. You'll report at whatever time on...
This is 2003.
February 10th. And, you know, first you go through all the different emotions. My first thing wasn't even, like, sadness or whatever. It was, I need to get that check back from the bursar's office and... you know, make sure that everything's okay with school. And, like, first it was just, like, this initial check plan. Got to get this done. Got to make sure, you know, I've got all my boots and all that kind of stuff. And then after probably the first 3 hours of just trying to get things done, then it hit me. And then I started to make phone calls of, you know, I've got a report in a few days. And
must have been intense.
Very intense. Very intense.
And so this was right before the Iraq war started.
Mm-hmm. And then we were stripped up at Fort McCoy. As you probably remember, Turkey closed their borders at that time. And so what originally was going to be U.S. troops coming in from both the north and the south, from Turkey and Kuwait, ended up all of us funneling through Kuwait at one time. And so there was this back jam and backlog of all these troops. And we got pushed into that backlog. We didn't really know what we were doing mission-wise, what was going on. So we got stuck up at Fort McCoy for until May, late May of 2003.
So you didn't get there until Baghdad had fallen?
Correct.
Were you stationed where? I heard you were stationed in Tikrit, is that right?
That was our base station, which means for the first couple of months we worked right there in Tikrit. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to get put on a humanitarian project, something that I really fought to get on and ended up being one of the best things I did in Iraq.
What was that project?
It was basically we went around to a couple local schools in Tikrit and helped them learn how to take in like contracts and bids. And over, I don't know, probably a couple month period, we got to actually watch schools be rebuilt or, you know, fixed up to a point where they were in suitable situation for children to come in and learn. So that was a great project, and I guess that's more what I had in my mind. You know, we talk about the hearts and minds missions and going in there and doing humanitarian missions and all that kind of stuff. That's what I was looking forward to, and that's what I saw in my mind is what we would be doing as, I guess, these quote-unquote liberators.
But at this stage, several years down the road now, it seems like that humanitarian effort is fallen by the wayside or is kind of doomed because of people's reactions now?
Yeah, it definitely still goes on. And I still talk to troops that are doing humanitarian projects there. They're still building up schools, police stations, you know, stuff that does good for the people of Iraq. Unfortunately, a lot of those things, you know, months after they're built, weeks after they're built, sometimes even days after they're built, are bombed by the insurgents. And I think as a soldier, that's something that's kind of hard to harness and work with, you know, is the fact that, you know, we did do something good and then it's been blown up.
So that leads to a feeling of discouragement.
It's kind of like this cyclical feeling of,
you know, what are we doing?
We did good and then the good that we built up and did was destroyed.
And did you see the reaction of the Iraqi people change over time while you were there, or how would you characterize it?
You know, I think it varied from places to places that we went. Like, you might go into a town where the children were blowing you kisses and giving you the thumbs up sign. You could go into a town that's dead silent and you could just feel the hairs in the back of your neck stand up. So it really did depend from place to place.
What were some of the most harrowing experiences you had over there?
I guess I got to witness and ultimately aid a guy that who was selflessly putting his life on his line for a fellow comrade. We were in a bombing in Bakuba, which I'm sure you've heard about recently in the news, and ran back into a building that was under fire. When I came in, there was four people on the ground, two Iraqi nationals that we had hired to come in and contracted out, and two Americans. An American male was aiding a female who was on the ground. And, you know, we were working by a flashlight, and as we were going by, I noticed all this blood on the floor, and he was still very attentive to her and trying to get a wound on her neck to heal. And I shouted out, "Is this your blood, or is this all her blood?" And he's like, "No, I think I've been hit, but I'm not that bad." And it turned out that this gentleman was, in fact, hurt worse than the woman he was working on. And I ended up working on his arm and for several months later, and it's still kind of up in the air whether or not he lost his arm.
But they both survived.
They both survived. Mm. All four of the people, including the Iraqi nationals that were in the building that night, survived.
But that scene must have been something to behold.
It was pretty horrific. And I think a lot of it comes back to that feeling of, you know, who can you trust? Are we doing good? Are we doing bad here? Because, you know, you do go out and do those humanitarian projects and you feel like you're making way with the people that are you're around you. And then you don't know if it's those same people that are bombing you at night that you just fed during the day. And for me, I was really angry after it happened. You know, I basically held this guy in my arm who was, you know, in a very life-threatening position, you know, due to the amount of blood loss and stuff like that. And I was angry to a point that I've never been in my entire life. And that was hard to deal with.
Mm-hmm. That anger, sometimes when soldiers are patrolling, after they've lost one of their comrades, that may lead to some of the atrocities that we have heard about. Do you how dangerous is that level of anger, do you think?
I know for myself that if I would have been around the person, I mean, if I would have known the person who did that at that moment, it would have been very hard for me to take them captive and, you know, do everything that's in the proper right way to do. And you hope that your friends and your comrades there will keep you in line. And I would have. I know I would have. But it would have been very difficult because of all the stuff that you saw. And so I understand and I can sympathize with what soldiers go through. You know, we look at Haditha and the stuff that's going on right now. But at the same time, we cannot excuse that type of behavior.
Did that story surprise you?
It didn't surprise me, which is unfortunate. I guess I was more upset by the cover-up that happened. You know, if a soldier does do something that is inhumane as that, it needs to be investigated right away. And to cover it up like we did does a great injustice for not only the people of Iraq, but for the military as a whole, because we set a precedence that, you know, this type of action will be covered up instead of not tolerated, which is what should be, you know, what should be flown down through our chain of command.
I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Abby Pickett, who served with the Army National Guard in Iraq. That Haditha scene was grotesque in so many ways. It was a sexual crime, and then it was a murder, multiple murder. You have spoken a little bit about sexual harassment in the military. How serious a problem is that?
It's hard to get statistics. I've heard as high as 2 in 3 women in the military will
as
be.
As high as what?
2 in 3. 2 of 3 women in the military.
2 out of every 3 women in the military experiences
will be
it.
Sexually assaulted or sexually harassed at some point in their career. That's a very, very high number. I've talked to a lot of women. I can't say that number is accurate. You know, I've heard as low as 1 in 5. Either way, that's much higher than you'd ever see in any other workforce in the nation. And you would not see that being accepted anywhere else in the nation. And so we need to start holding the armed forces accountable. We need to start making rules tighter, and we need to start cinching up on that because these are unacceptable numbers. And, you know, I watched the movie North Country, and it really made me angry, and it really brought back, you know, some unfriendly emotion. And I was just like, you know, that is not to that extreme, but that is a lot of what you put up with, the everyday crap, and it shouldn't be tolerated. And at 17, I didn't know what to compare it to because I had never been in a real workforce, and to say, you know, no, this isn't okay. And you're putting a lot of pressure on the victim to step up each time when it shouldn't be the victim that always has to step up and say, this is not okay. It shouldn't even be a question of whether or not it should happen in that workforce or in the field.
And did you have to stand up at some point and say enough's enough?
I was sexually assaulted when I was 19 and in Nicaragua. At the time, I didn't say anything. I think I was...
By whom?
It was by a fairly high-ranking superior officer.
Wow, that must have been...
Yeah, you know what? Like, it actually happened, you know, so... Not fast, but, like, it was all just kind of a blur, and I didn't know how to deal with it, and I wasn't under-ranking, and I didn't know what to say, and, you know, there's so many different layers to each story, I think. And I think that you are much more likely to get assaulted when you're younger and you're more not knowing how to stick up for yourself or fend for yourself. And I think that you can get taken advantage of really easily because there is that superior inferior relationship that happens in the military, and you really can't understand unless you've experienced. It's not like the workforce. It's, you know, someone asks you to do a job and you do it, and you're not really supposed to question why. I mean, that wasn't I'd always question why, but that didn't really win me a lot of friends in the military. And so I think that that sets people up for, you know, unfortunately, it sets them up for failure.
You don't fault yourself for not speaking up at the time, do you?
Looking back on it, I wish I would have been strong enough to speak up and that I would have known kind of what to do. But I definitely think I was working with a woman on a case here within the last year. And, you know, they didn't give her – she did speak up, and it was because I was helping her out and I was advocating for her. But the military didn't supply an advocate like they say they will. You know, there was no one sitting there. There was no chaplain. There was no one walking her through the process. Still to this day, she's not completely sure of what happened with the perpetrator's case, because the perpetrator has rights and, you know, such. And, you know, she doesn't really know if it was even worthwhile to speak up and come out. And I think that's a great injustice.
There's a case recently of a woman who doesn't want to return to Iraq, Suzanne Swift, I think her name is, because of the sexual harassment was so rampant. She told the story of asking her commanding officer where she should report for duty, and I think he responded allegedly, "In my bed, naked."
Right.
And did that anecdote surprise you, or is that run of the mill?
You know, if someone would ever have said that, I would have probably laughed it off more of as a joke, just because I got so thick-skinned by the time.
So that doesn't sound that out of the ordinary.
Yeah, but I would have laughed it off and probably said something very smirky back. But once again, that shouldn't be put on her shoulders. And, you know, you have to be very, very quick on your feet when something like that happens. Like, sometimes you're just so shocked and awed by it that you don't really know what to say. And sometimes you don't even realize how wrong it is until, like, someone points it out. You know, it wasn't until I was home several months and I was talking about the amount of pornography that just ran rampant in Iraq. And, you know, I was like, well, the guys are away from home, and I think it's just a part of being a soldier. And they're like, no, that shouldn't happen in any workforce, and you shouldn't be subject to walking in on that at any time. And so I think it's having somebody that can point it out and say, no, that really shouldn't happen. And then you get to kind of think about it, about how wrong it was. And from what I've heard, in her case, is she had actually been sexually assaulted prior. So it kind of, I think, too, it adds up, and then there's just this breaking point, and it might be with a comment or with whatever else. And she was set to head back to Iraq after her first tour. I think it was under the 16 months that normally it's been allotted for people coming back. And so it was said that she's been in treatment, too, for PTSD. Mm. So there's a lot of things in her case.
Abby Pickett, you've been doing a lot of work on PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. When did you recognize that you had it?
You know, that it's a term that's flung around all the time when you're coming home and you go through these demobilization briefings, and it didn't really hit me. At the time, I thought I was depressed. I had been through some strenuous stuff with my leadership, some things that I thought were pretty unfair. And I thought I was just really depressed, and I thought it would go away. And then you go through this little bit of a honeymooners period where, you know, you're happy to have a flushing toilet and electricity again. So, like, the fact that you're jumping at certain noises, or you can't sleep yet, you're still not addressing, or at least I wasn't. But I started seeking help just for the depression right away. Right now I'm one of my majors is psychology. So, you know, I was a little bit up to tune on that. But it probably wasn't until I saw it in other vets, at least a year after I'd been home, that I really accepted the fact of PTSD and said, you know, that's what I've got.
The depression got pretty bad, I understand. You had very regular suicidal thoughts. And how would that come on, and how grave was that?
You know, it would come on at the most random of moments. You know, I could be driving down the road and just think about steering my car off it, or like I'd look down at to see how fast I was going, and it'd be up to like 95. And it wasn't something I was consciously doing, but it was going on. Or, you know, I might hold a knife in my hand and just think bad thoughts. But those thoughts, at their worst, were, you know, a couple times every hour. I mean, I wasn't sleeping more than 45 minutes to 50 minutes a night. A
couple times every hour, that's frequent.
Yeah.
And it's
couldn't
a problem.
Get out of it, is the thing.
It's a problem with returning vets. I talked with a mom the other day from Iowa who lost her son 4 months after he came back. Mm-hmm. And I think there have been dozens of soldiers who've actually committed suicide after coming back.
Yeah, I've been working with a group called Vets for Vets, and, you know, just reaching out to other vets and being able in a safe environment to tell our stories and be able to feel that other people are at the exact same spot with things, and knowing that it's okay to feel these feelings and that there is help out there to get and to seek that one-on-one counseling too on top of that has been very instrumental.
What is that help like? Is that out of the VA, or how would you assess the VA's ability to give help here?
I'd say the VA, they have great clinicians and great people working there. The problem is they're so underfunded that it's hard to get in. And I think that's across the board.
That's a real problem for people who are severely depressed, because you need help right away if you're
right.
That depressed.
You know, I got in after a month or two of trying to get in. I mean, just really trying to advocate for myself. And I really couldn't do a very good job of that because I was so depressed at the time. Got in for a few months. Went from like July until November to see a psychiatrist. In December, I missed an appointment. And then they said, I called, you know, up the next day when I realized what happened. And they said, we'll send you something out in the mail. We'll get you covered. A month went by, 2 months went by, 4 months went by, 5 months went by. And I'm very suicidal at this point. The medication that they have, a doctor's refilling, but it's not under any kind of like psychiatrist observation or anything like that. And so things got really, really bad, and I didn't actually get back in until August. So I went from December until August without care or regulation of my medicine.
That's dangerous, yeah. What we have a minute left about. What would you suggest to returning soldiers or loved ones, families of returning soldiers who are struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder? What should they do?
Well, I think that the best thing to realize is you're not alone, and to find other people in your community, or even just in the nation that you can hook up with, whether it's a phone call. There's a great program called Marines for Life for Marines out there. And basically what they found is that just reaching out and contacting a Marine and just saying, hey, how's your day going, has really made the difference between life and death. For myself, I found an organization called Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America, which is formerly known as Operation Truth. And they took me in. They gave me a voice, which I didn't have. You know, I didn't have when I was in Iraq. I lost it when I came home. And let me tell my story. And that was the most beautiful thing, in having other people be able to relate to my story. So I encourage people to check out the website, www.iava.org, and to go to Vets for Vets, which is a kind of like a 12-step program for veterans if they're struggling. Also, there are vet centers located in just about every city in the nation. And so if you're struggling, they do drop-ins, and just drop in there and get some help.
That's great advice. Abby Pickett, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.